Okay, let's get started. Where is this doing this? Oh, yes. So to recap, what we did last time was actually a lot of stuff. Oops. We talked about interrupts. We talked about system calls. We talked about context switching. The only thing I did wrong or restricted was I assumed you have one CPU. If you have multiple CPUs, it's very similar because, you have interrupts going to multiple CPUs, but they're executing the same interrupt handler. It doesn't matter which CPU fields the interrupt. The system calls happen simultaneously, but that happens on a single CPU also. It just gets re-entered. But in a multi-CPU system, it'll be parallel execution. So we have to still really figure out how to write re-entrant code for having multiple simultaneous parallel executions. And we talked about context switching. Switching from one process to another, it is easier than you think it is, but it is kind of strange that an interrupt goes inside the kernel and comes out, doesn't come out, goes away. Okay? Do operating systems really do round-robin-based context switching? The answer is yes. This is just an infinite loop. Okay? Nothing interesting, but what happened here? This is what the problem is with this computer. It gets stuck. So yeah, it is running all four. Somehow this computer is slow. On a reasonable one, you would see all four running properly. And if I do this, it's getting stuck, which it shouldn't. I don't know. But so that's showing you that it's actually context switching between multiple processes. Okay? We've also used words like atomicity. Critical sections, which is also similar to mutual exclusion, which is something to do with locking. So we've talked about these things. Are these just terms or is this there's something more to it? There's a little bit more to it. Atomicity or atomic means undivisible. So if you've got an atomic instruction, it has to be done all at once. If it's multiple instructions which have to be atomic, they all have to be executed without interference from anybody. Multiple instructions that are atomic don't exist. We have to do something if we want multiple instructions which are atomic, which is something we're going to talk about today. We do want multiple instructions that are atomic. But it's not provided to us by hardware manufacturers. They only support one or maybe two atomic instructions like test and set or exchange or something like that. Okay. Critical sections or mutual exclusion, what's the difference? I mean, critical sections is a superset. It has progress and bounded weighting also. Mutual exclusion is the most critical thing that we want. These don't have to be... don't have to be undivisible. They might be divisible. Two things. It can be divisible. That is, if you're running in a critical section, you can stop that, do something else, come back to it. But this something else, or a parallel execution might happen along with a critical section. But this parallel execution or this something else must not be another critical section. As long as it's a non-critical section, it's okay. I can even weaken that. I'm not saying that a critical section cannot be run with a critical section. You can run a critical section with a critical section as long as they are not of the same critical section type. So there is an association or type of critical sections. Essentially, if you've got lock on X and lock on Y, they can run simultaneously. But lock on X and lock on X cannot run simultaneously. So it's X is associated with something, Y is associated with something, they're critical sections, and they're mutually exclusive. But they are not really atomic. They don't run all in one shot. So to clear up this whole thing about locks, critical sections, atomicity, what I want to do is I really want to introduce or talk about semaphores. Why semaphores? There are other things that there's locks, there's conditions, there's barriers. These things are all methods of attaining something. But the semaphore is a very interesting concept which can do anything any of those others can do. It's kind of like this almost superset. And it is a very old concept which has been around forever, but we all build our concepts around semaphores. And who invented semaphores? When? Before computers were invented. 64. That old. So we're really talking old stuff here. Dijkstra. So it says semaphore, what is it? It is a data type. Is it an integer? The answer is maybe. A semaphore, as presented initially, is an integer, but we don't think of it as an integer. It's a data type that supports three operations, not like plus or increment or anything like that. Now, this is kind of bizarre, but you have to come up, think of semaphores as a class, as an object type, as something that's opaque. What's in it is not the issue here. In fact, you're not supposed to see what's in it. And I'll keep repeating that you don't look at it, you only use it. So it contains things like init, P, and V. P and V are, some people call it wait and signal, some people call it up and down, but that's the original, and that's how I at least treat semaphores. It's got two operations, P and V. Initialization takes a semaphore and initializes it and initialize it so it's to a value. V is an integer, positive. Okay? So it's a positive integer that you initialize the semaphore to, which means semaphore is an integer. No, semaphore may be implemented as an integer, may be implemented as a pointer to an integer, may be implemented as a structure which contains all kinds of things. We're not saying how it is implemented. That's an implementation issue. And we will, right today, implement it in a bunch of different ways. But, so you initialize the semaphore, give it an initial value. It has a value field. It may have other fields. And then you can't check the value anymore. You can do a P operation or a V operation. Right? So what are these P operations and V operations that we're going to do? A P operation on a semaphore says, and at this point I'm going to treat the semaphore as an integer. If S is greater than 0, then S minus minus. Else, so I'm using a go-to. How terrible. Programming languages do have a go-to statement. Is that taught anymore? Assembly language, yes. You cannot live without go-tos in assembly language. But in any higher level language, C has it, but so it's being taught. I think all languages have it, but I'm not. Okay. So this is the original definition by Dijkstra. Now somebody soon after that wrote a paper whose title was Go-tos Considered Harmful. Yes, it was Dijkstra. And go-tos considered harmful, people were like shocked. What do you mean go-tos are harmful? Yes, they are. So then there's a whole lot of like stories about why go-tos are harmful, and it was pretty debatable. People went on talking about it. How is this? How can I write a program? Because nobody knows how to write a program without go-tos. So those days are over. We don't use go-tos. Why did I use a go-to? I'll tell you in a minute. Somehow this go-to here is the most elegant definition of a semaphore I've seen. I'll rewrite it without the go-to, and it's not quite that good. So go-tos are harmful. That has been completely understood, well established. We all agree. What we don't seem to understand is that you do not, going one step forward, you do not check the value of a semaphore or a lock. No, don't do it. It's a harmful thing. But again, it's difficult to explain why is it harmful. Why can't I check the value? And they'll be hand-waving, okay, because the value might change. You're making decisions on something that may not be true and all that. But is that really? I'll just check the value and I'll play my game. But it leads to wrong programming, just like go-to. If you use go-tos, you can write correct programs, but you may not. If you check values, you may write correct programs, but you have a higher chance of failure. Okay? So we'll go with, you do not check. You only use. So what's going on here? P operation says if S is greater than 0, then decrement S. But after you've checked S is greater than 0, it might change. How do you know S is greater than 0 after you've checked it? Classic race condition. You're supposed to decrement it only after you've checked, only while it is larger than 0. And so there is no way of really stating that in programming. Okay? So, we draw a red box around it and say this is atomic. Both the check and the decrement is atomic. In reality, decrement is not atomic. If two people decrement the value of X is 2, S is 2, two processes or threads decrement the value of S, the answer will be 1 or 0. That means it's not atomic. If it was atomic, the answer would be 0. So, since we don't have a way of saying this is atomic, this is the human way of saying this is atomic. Okay? I can also do something like this. The second writing is the same as the first one. Check it. It's the same thing. But I think the first one kind of shows it better. But that's personal preference. No, there is another way of writing the while loop, but I didn't bring a note, so. There's something called, this is called a counting semaphore because the value of S can be any positive number. There's something called a binary semaphore where the value of S can be only 0 and 1. So instead of confusing matters, let's only go with counting semaphores. The binary semaphore is totally equivalent to a lock. There's no difference. The counting semaphore does the same thing if you keep the value between 0 and 1, but it can do more. So let's just stick to counting semaphores. So what does this mean? It means if the value of semaphore is greater than 0, exactly what the first one says, it says that if the value of the semaphore is greater than 0, decrement it immediately in one step. Even if you have multiple processors, only one should be able to do it, unless if the value is 2, but one should be able to decrement it, then the next person sees what the value is and decrements it atomically. And if the value of the semaphore is not greater than 0, then you keep checking, is it greater than 0? No, it's not. Okay, is it greater than 0? Why are we checking? We just found out it's not greater than 0. It is 0. We're checking in the hopes that it changes. Because if it doesn't change, if it's 0, we are not allowed to execute the next statement. We are not allowed to finish the P routine. When the P routine is finished, it means that the value of the semaphore before the P routine executed was 1. And if it's not 1, we will still make it 1 by having somebody else make it 1. It's a little bizarre. It's not like regular programming. You don't keep on checking the value of something which is false. Right? So if I wanted to put this piece of code in my program, it wouldn't work because atomic. I can't write atomic code. So how do we put this piece of code in my program and make it work correctly? We've got to find an implementation of a semaphore. Okay. So my first attempt at actually implementing semaphores using real code would be to I would define semaphore as a structure which has a count and a lock. And both would be integers, but now the semaphore is not an integer, it's a structure with 2 integers in it. And that's about it. I'm not writing the initialization routine. If I want to initialize the semaphore to 1, I would set the value of count to 1. And the value of lock to, 1 means lock, test and set. lock will be zero, that is unlocked. Okay? And then I would write a spin lock on something I, which will be we've covered that before. Test and set on I, if I is 0, it'll set it to 1. If it's 1, it'll get stuck. Okay? Now I do a P operation on S. So what am I doing? I spin lock the lock part of the semaphore. There are lots of semaphores. This is a particular semaphore. I don't need atomicity with the other semaphores. I want atomicity on this semaphore. So when I'm using the semaphore, I use a spin lock to lock the semaphore. And everybody who uses the semaphore uses the same spin lock on the same variable, so we have critical sections. That's how we get atomicity. Then I check whether the semaphore count is zero or not. If it's not, I should increment the semaphore and unlock it. I forgot the unlock. Okay? And if it is indeed zero, then what choice do I have? I cannot progress any further. I can unlock the semaphore, but then I'll have to check for the value of zero again, so I'll have to lock the semaphore again. So that looks like terrible code, but that's the only code that works. Does that make sense? Any questions so far?
Could you repeat this one?
Which part? Okay, I'm locking the semaphore. What does this statement do? This statement? This has a test and set in it. If this process thread is running without interference from anybody, this S dot lock will be set to 1, which is locked. Okay? But if it's already locked, then it'll get stuck here. It'll spin until it's not locked. Then it can continue. Moment it continues, you know that you've got a critical section associated with the semaphore or associated with the lock. Nobody at this point is going to mess with the semaphore. So whatever value you check is not going to change. So if it is 1, which is what you want, you decrement it to 0, there'll be no race conditions, and you've achieved whatever you wanted, you unlock it. So this part is the clean part. Now, if it is indeed 0, then you cannot decrement it. The semaphore definition said you just have to spin if it is 0. So now you're going to spin. You cannot spin with the spin lock locked because it's not going to change. So you allow somebody to change it by unlocking it and hoping before you lock it again, somebody else is going to grab it and change it. And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. You are left at the mercy of fate and the gods and whatever. But you have to lock it before you check it. And this is the only time, inside a P routine, is the only time where we check the value of a semaphore. Once we do that, everybody else uses P and V. They are not allowed to check. Only P and V routines are allowed to check. And they have to be written carefully. Okay. Any further questions, or did I answer that correctly? That's the same. What does the unlock do? Okay, what does the unlock do? I didn't define unlock. Anybody? What does the unlock do? The actual code for unlock. I is equal to 0. Okay, I'm changing I. Shouldn't I be locking I before I change I? It's already locked. Okay. So the unlock is actually, this whole thing is atomic or critical section. Similarly, up to here it's atomic, then it locks itself and goes back, it's all atomic.
Again, here calling the lock and unlock, I mean, P and V as a pair. That is a program ratio, right? We don't protect anything of that sort. I mean, say for example, if V is called multiple times, then we don't have any mechanism to...
No. It's very primitive operations. You use it wrong, your problem. So, at the lowest level, you have these locks, which is implemented by the hardware instruction test and set. Then the next level you have the P and V implementations because these locks don't have any counters or anything. You cannot do much with it other than locking. Then you build P and V, which has some more features that we'll talk about. And then you can use them from user level code, like pthreads or whatever. You can use those from user level code. You can use them for kernel code also. So when you're writing kernel code, you're not rewriting semaphores all over the place. The written semaphores once, that's what you use. You generally don't even use spin locks. So avoid using anything other than semaphores. But this is a spin lock version of a semaphore. Now it gets complicated. So let's look at this one, then we'll do another version of a semaphore. Okay, why are we using spin locks? Because we need atomicity. What were the two ways of getting atomicity? Test and set and exchange, same thing. Test and set, exchange, hardware instructions. Peterson. Okay, we're not going to use Peterson.
Interrupt
disable, yes. Why don't we use interrupt disable? Now we were... Let's just say I'm using test and set. Okay, there are two answers. First answer is, I'm using test and set. Does it, okay. And say I am running on a single CPU machine. Okay. And I come here and do a spin lock on S.lock and it's locked. Okay, so I'm going to do a test and set and test and set, and is anything going to change? I'm the only process running. I need somebody else to change it. Nothing's going to change. So I'm guaranteed once you get hit with a spin lock, you're going to spin. There's nobody else. So that says maybe it's a bad idea to use a spin lock when you have one CPU. You might be wanting to use something else, like a disable, it'll immediately work. Okay. Secondly, so let's put disables here. And forget about spin lock. Well, what if you have two processors? One processor does a disable, he's disabled his interrupts. The other processor can execute P and you don't get atomicity. Because they're two actual processors. You did not lock the other processor, you just locked yourself from context switching. Disable enable does not work for multiprocessors. And spin locks work for uniprocessors, but they're unnecessarily causes increases in spinning. So the other version, one version of the semaphores, this is the semaphores for multiprocessors. So replace spin lock and unlock with disable and enable, and spin lock takes an argument, the log variable, ignore that. And don't use this for multiprocessors, it doesn't work. So there is that difference between a uniprocessor implementation of a semaphore and a multiprocessor implementation of a semaphore.
For the previous one, implementation of V is just going to be spin
lock. Okay. Implementation of V will be spin lock, S dot lock, S dot count plus plus, and spin unlock, whatever the variable is. Yeah. Just increment the count. Okay. Yeah.
What is the implementation of binary semaphore and
this? Binary semaphore just don't... why are we going to talk? S dot count, S count plus plus, change it to S equals 1. S dot count equals 1. And where you're doing a minus minus, you just make it 0. And that we are blindly changing values and can be a problem, because if you do two unlocks, one unlock will disappear. And so I try to steer you away from binary semaphores. But the mutex locks in pthreads are binary semaphores, so you don't have a choice. But watch out, those things are bad. Yeah. Okay, you'll have to speak louder. The previous...
In the previous one?
In this one?
Yeah.
Okay.
KTM set count equals to P.
Yes.
And then there are two threads of producers which are trying to be P.
Yeah.
And say getting succeeded, for example.
Yeah.
And then, so then when they come to P routine, and they both try to do the discussion set, right? And we have just like...
It'll still get serialized because the spin lock will take it. If two people are allowed to go in, they will block each other out for a little bit, and then they can pass the P, both of them, and set the value to 0. Well, if you've set the value to 2, it's no longer a lock.
Yeah.
So if you set the value of the semaphore to 1, it's a lock. When you, there are situations where you set it to 2, that's for fancier programming, it's no longer a lock. So, now what? I don't know. I'm not even going to talk about values of semaphores. Semaphore value is set to 1. It's initialized semaphore to 1, not semaphore value equals 1. You can't use an assignment statement there. But conceptually, S is set to 1. That's the only time you play with the values. That means one process can get into the critical section. If one of them is here, the other two will not cross over P. They will get stuck in P. Okay? But if I take some time here, because I'm doing lots and lots of stuff, those two will waste time spinning. Maybe I don't want that. Okay? Is there a better way of implementing semaphores? Yes, there is. Okay? And that's called a mutex semaphore. So this is a spin semaphore, and there's a mutex semaphore. This is a Dijkstra semaphore, and then the other one is a locking semaphore or mutex semaphore. So to do that, so I don't want all this spinning. I want proper behavior where if you can't progress, you need to stop doing whatever it is doing. You're not supposed to be spinning. But so far, we found the spinning is the only way to say, I cannot go further, I have to spin. So how do we do better semaphores? Before we talk about mutex semaphores, let's talk about most of you in programming may have used the sleep routine. The sleep routine is very similar to other routines we will be using, but it is based on time. You can sleep for a certain amount of time. And there is so many seconds sleep, so many milliseconds sleep. This time is meaningless. I am trying to coordinate programs that wait for each other, wait for you to finish your critical section, wait for you to generate some results. There's a lot of waiting issued here, but not for waits amount of time. I can think that, okay, process one goes first, whatever he does will be done in 1 second, so if process two waits for 1 second, so I put a sleep one, it'll be fine. It will be fine, but it's not guaranteed to be fine. We want correct program. We want to execute when this is done, not assume it'll be done in 1 second. Okay? Time becomes meaningless in any form of process coordination. So we're not going to use sleep. In your projects, you will be told to use sleep to slow things down so that we humans can see what's going on. Okay? It's not for correctness. Block means so block is a word that we use to mean block forever. That is, once you execute block, you're gone. You won't be woken up by the operating system. You may be woken up by your friend, but no, something has to happen to wake you up. Sleep, of course, you will be woken up after a certain amount of time. And yield is another way of blocking or sleeping. Yield means I don't want to go further right now. I'll do it later. And I'm not specifying how much later. But wake me up after some time. Give somebody else a chance to execute. Okay, that sounds like weird. Why? What's the point? It doesn't say that you have to wait for a certain amount of time or block forever. It just says, I'll do it later. And it's surprisingly useful. What happens is that you're put somewhere by the scheduler and you're woken up when your turn comes up, which could be as quickly as immediately because there's nothing else to do, or could be a few time quanta, finite number, depending upon how many other jobs there are. So that's very flaky, but it's useful. And we will use such things in our implementations of semaphores.
The difference between the why we use yield and not sleep.
Yeah, I didn't explain that. But you'll see that yield is actually more useful than sleep because yield does not have a time set to it. It says start it when necessary. But when is it necessary? Programmers can make it work. I can't explain it, but my usage will explain it. So now I've changed my semaphore type to a structure consisting of three elements, a counter, a lock, and a queue. What's this queue? Queue is a data structure where you can add elements and take out elements, and these elements are PCBs or TCBs, same thing. What is this TCB-PCB? It's a structure containing some process-oriented information and at least a stack pointer and things like that. Okay? And that's become much more complex now. And I will implement the semaphore as a P operation. I will not have while loops in here. I will lock the semaphore dot lock, spin lock or whatever. Okay. Okay, let me write this part and then I'll explain. Ignore that code that I've written on that side of the statement. If I do a P operation on a semaphore, I first lock it. I first decrement the semaphore, regardless of what its value is. Okay? So now that I've decremented it, it could be 0. Oh, well, if it started at 2, then it'll be 1. It'll be 1 less. But this could be a negative number. I'll show you why it could be a negative number. Or it could be 0. If it is 0, it means it was a 1. And if it was a 1, I'm good to go. The original one says if S is 1, then it's decremented to 0 and you're good to go. So if it was 1, I unlock the semaphore, I get out. P is done. And if it's not a 1, if it's negative, that means something has happened. Why would it be negative? It would be negative because I'm going to that 3 threads with P's and V's. Where is that? Here. If this guy goes first, the value will drop from 1 to 0. Okay? Then this guy comes around, he will take the value down to minus 1, and execute some code. Then this guy comes around, he'll take it down to minus 2. That's why you don't check the value. Negative values of semaphores are undefined. If you checked it and got a negative number, you go like, what? Semaphores are only defined as positive numbers. So it's an implementation issue. You don't check the value. But this is correct code. You are making the semaphore value go negative. But if this is negative 1, it means you can't go further. Negative 2 means you can't go further. Okay? So what do you do? We are not supposed to be spinning. So we have in our system, conceptually, there is a ready queue. That has a PCB. And that's queued up with more PCBs. These are the processes or threads that run. And this is my scheduler. Remember the context switcher? We talked about the scheduler with a queue of PCBs where you're storing contexts and stack pointers and all that stuff. That's what that is. I said delete a PCB from the ready queue. What PCB are you deleting? The PCB of the process that just is running. That's my PCB. Somebody called P, that process's PCB is at the top of the ready queue. I'm assuming single processor. When it's multiprocessor, you have to just find out which PCB it is. So you take my PCB off of the ready queue. Okay? just deleting a PCB from the ready queue doesn't stop the process. The process is going to continuously execute, and you lose that PCB, and something strange will happen later. So now you carefully put it back somewhere, and you put it inside a queue associated with the semaphore. The semaphore is a data structure. It does have a holder for a queue. You put it there. That means you've hidden it from the scheduler. The scheduler will never find this, will not run this. So it's blocked forever, not yet blocked forever. Then you invoke a context switch routine, which dumps the old context of me, the process that's running, onto the PCB that's hidden in the semaphore queue, give it a pointer, and loads the context from the next process in the ready queue. Okay? Now, this fella who did a P operation and got a negative is gone. Blocked forever, not spinning, somebody else is running. But that's exactly what we wanted. And yes, it has spin locks, and the spin locks will lock things for a very short amount of time. So this one spin lock will lock it from here to here. Right? That small amount of code is just got an check and a decrement in it. And another spin lock will lock it from here to here, which is also a short amount of time. It will do a little bit of queue manipulation and a context switch.
But won't we, if we context switch already, the current process, how will it continue to come back?
How will it come back? That's the mystery. This code says you'll never come back. Okay, so block is block forever. Yeah, back there. Yes. One thing with blocking is that all processes are controlled through a bunch of PCBs. Every process, and I use the word process to mean process or thread, every process or thread has a PCB. What does this PCB contain? It contains information about the save state of a process. Contains a stack pointer, maybe some registers, maybe a process ID, some other information. The process, there is one process in a uniprocessor that's running. It also has a PCB, but that PCB is out of date because the stack pointer is in the CPU register. It's moving like all over the place, but the PCB is just somewhere in memory. It's got an old stack pointer in it. So the process that's running, its PCB is not current. It's not reflecting. Now, in order to do a context switch, we go into an interrupt routine. We save the fresh stack pointer of the running process into its PCB. We load the stack pointer from a non-running process into the CPU register. We do a return, and suddenly the process switches. So in order to block things and run things, we have to use a bunch of PCBs. So we organize the PCBs as a system-wide global ready queue, where the beginning of the ready queue is the process that's running. And the rest of them are stuck there. We will get to them later on our time quantas. And this guy comes in, and it is this guy. Okay? Whoever is executing is the top one. This guy takes its own PCB out of the ready queue. Doesn't matter, it's a data structure. Sticks it into the semaphore queue, calls a context switcher which saves the current stack pointer into the semaphore queue, loads a stack pointer from the ready queue, somebody else's, and returns, causing it to return to some other process. And this process is just gone, dead. Okay? That's how semaphores actually work.
we had the spin lock implementation of Semaphore, right? The same thing, instead of using a spin lock, if we use the already we have discussed about a mutex lock, which does the same.
This is the mutex lock. That mutex lock I discussed was kind of hand wavy. You block, you. So this is the real code. We can actually implement this.
Okay.
So it's the same thing. I'm just showing you where the lock points are and where the queues are and all that. Yeah. What is a semaphore queue? A semaphore is a data type. Any programmer can define any number of semaphores, S1, S2, S3. In your data area, you say semaphore S1, S2, S3. Now you've got three queues. Your scheduler is an OS routine which doesn't know about you declaring semaphores.
So does it store
It stores a pointer to a queue which consists of items of type PCB. Which is not in the ready queue. Ready queue is a special system-wide queue stored in the scheduler. Semaphore queues are user-defined or kernel-defined holders for PCBs.
Could you explain why you have two unlocks and only one spin lock? I have miscode.
Okay, this needs to be else. Okay, yeah, it's slight miscode is else because I cannot use this unlock to unlock. It'll never get there. So this unlock has to be embedded inside the context switcher or before the context switcher, and it gets a little hairy. Where do we put this unlock? If it's before the context switcher, maybe it'll work, depends on exactly how this is implemented, or somewhere inside the context switcher.
So that unlock is for something that happens within the context switcher?
That is, you have to unlock before you actually go to sleep, because somebody has to execute the unlock. Because if you context switch out and then you put the unlock, you are gone before you did the unlock. So it's important that you did the unlock. So this unlock is not going to work when you come that way, so this is only for the else part. When you switch from
the semaphore queue to the ready queue,
No, you've locked out that semaphore completely. Other people will have to use the semaphore. You cannot do the unlock then. You need to unlock right away. Things that are locked have to be unlocked right away. Okay? Otherwise, somebody will spin there'll be a deadlock. Somebody else trying to use the semaphore will not get it, and that somebody might be doing a V operation which would wake you up. The V operation on a semaphore. It used to be as simple as increment the semaphore. Now it's no longer that simple. Yeah. This guy?
Yeah. Once you context switched, how would you be able to execute the unlock statement?
You put it in the context switcher just before the return instruction. Okay? So that unlock has to be done just before the return instruction, after you've switched the queues around.
Again, here the assumption is like this S is visible across the process.
Yes, S is visible everywhere. So this might be a kernel routine. Okay, so I will increment the S, and it might come to zero. Okay, I keep I keep forgetting whether it should be less than 0 or less than equal to 0, but we'll solve that problem in a minute. The V routine says increment the semaphore first, after locking it, of course. And once you've incremented it, you check the value. What if the value is 1? What if the value is 0? If it's 1, there's nothing. If it's 0, there is a PCB somewhere in the queue. So this should be, okay? If it's 0 or less than 0, there is the count plus 1 PCBs sitting on the semaphore queue. And I want exactly one of them out of there. Okay, how did you know that there's a thingy sitting on the semaphore queue? If it is 1, you decremented it, nobody else decremented it to 0 after that, so nothing's there on the semaphore queue. If it is 0, that means you just incremented it, it was minus 1. If somebody took it down to minus 1, that somebody is there sitting in the semaphore queue. So now that it's 0, I'm going to take a PCB from the semaphore queue, which it was hidden out to pasture. I'm going to bring it back to life. Otherwise, nobody would bring it back to life. It'll sit there. And I actually dump it into the ready queue where the scheduler pays attention every timer tick. But I don't have to switch to it. I just put it in the ready queue. And I unlock and I go away, I can do a yield, I just put it there, it's not needed.
But we are not forcing it to context switch to that.
No, because that process, it's ready to go, but even a yield will not context switch to that one, it will switch to the next one. So the yield is not needed, but no, I don't need to force it to go there. It will come in at some point in time. If you're running on a uniprocessor, you change all the lock and unlock, which are spin lock and unlock, to disable enable. And the amount of time things are spin locked is very low. So if you're using mutex semaphores, these things, for doing critical sections, then you're guaranteed that once people are executing in the critical section and somebody else wants a critical section, they're not spinning. You have solve the problem of spinning. They only spin when two things try to do an operation on the same semaphore at the same point in time. That's highly unlikely. And if it does happen, it'll spin for a little bit. Most of the time, spin locks will not spin. And since the semaphore queues are first in, first served, they're queues, they will have bounded waiting. They will not have bounded weighting because of the spinning nature of the spin locks, but the window of vulnerability of no bounded weighting is very little. You shouldn't get into trouble. Okay, next is, of course, what do we do with these things? But does this make sense, or do you have questions?
So unless we patch the kernel, there is no way for us to program it.
No, because it has to have access to scheduler queues. So that's why this is in the kernel. And once this is in the kernel, kernel routines can use it. User processes have to use it through a system call. Any questions? Yes. Yes. You have the project on pthreads. Pthreads have mutex semaphores, which is mutex lock, binary semaphores, mutex lock, mutex unlock. It does not have mutex semaphores because it has conditions, but those conditions are bizarre. They're very easily converted to mutex semaphores. And I think I've given you a little one-liner which converts all the conditions into P's and V's. Those are mutex semaphores. They are implemented in the kernel. Yeah.
Once you put the PCB back to ready, shouldn't you increment the count again?
No. The semaphore count, no, you don't increment it. You increment it, and that's it. Because if it's still negative, it means there are so many more, and somebody else will do a V operation. So it's like this. So we have lots of P's. So this guy comes in, and then this, and then this, and then this. So finally, this takes it down to zero. Here the semaphore value is zero. Here it's minus one. Here it's minus two. Here it's minus three, right? When this guy goes out, he makes it minus two and wakes up somebody. When that guy does a V, he makes it minus one and wakes up somebody. That guy goes out, he makes it zero and wakes up somebody. When that guy goes out, he makes it plus one, which is where we started. So it'll all cascade properly. Every entry you decrement, every exit you... Every entry you decrement, every exit you increment.
Should there be only one implementation of mutex in
PERS? Unless if it's layered, yeah. There's just a P and a V routine, everybody uses that. Or there's a condition routine which pthreads uses.
Why I'm asking is like, we are deleting the PCB from ready queue and that thing happens, right? We are not saying that, though we have a spin lock, it guarantees that even if it context switches, it comes back.
Yes.
But this, if there are two different implementation of...
No, you don't.
Locks, then this...
Yeah. You have to have another spin lock on the ready queue, which I didn't show. That's part of the intricacies of writing the kernel. Actually... What does the Linux kernel do? Linux kernel is bizarre. There is a undocumented, hidden, you shouldn't know about it, don't touch it, routine called futex, fast mutex. And it is some bizarre combination of a spin lock and a mutex lock. And the kernel itself uses futex in the kernel code. It also has spin locks and bizarre. So the kernel code is bizarre. But futex is exported to the user processes via pthreads using things like mutex lock, which is not a semaphore. Mutex lock is a binary semaphore, and condition wait. And condition signal. Condition wait is very similar to a P, and condition signal is very similar to a V. And with mutex lock, condition wait, and condition signal, you can build your own P's and V's, or you can write your programs to just use the pthreads things. But they are written by using futex. And you are not supposed to be smart enough to use futex. You're disallowed. You can use it, but it's like, no. You will only use condition wait, condition signal, and mutex locks. But I'm trying to show how is it done, actually, not Linux. Everybody has its own ways of doing it. Actually, it's done by the method I showed. That's how semaphores. And you can break it up into two parts. One is a condition, one is a mutex lock. I'd rather put the whole thing together into a counting semaphore, and that's all you need. Okay, I think I'm out of time. Yeah, I am. Any questions?